delivering on that promise. No summer fun drive. We know how fatigued you are with being asked to donate so often. We also realize we're taking a chance, like walking a high wire without a net, to deliver on the bargain we've made. But you've done your part. You've been patient with us and very generous. And we owe you this fun drive free summer. We couldn't have done it without you. So enjoy the summer and don't worry your head about how we're doing financially. We'll be back in the fall with another fun drive full of new thank you gifts and information you can only get at 94.1 FM. Oh, for you listeners who are able to support us right now, you can donate online at KPFA.
All right, this is KBOO Portland, and that was a message that we probably shouldn't have let slide, as it was a Pacifica Radio for that exclusive station. But you are listening to community radio here in Portland, KBOO Portland. A minute now in front of 11 o'clock, and coming right up, we've got Between the Covers. Today, host David Naiman is speaking with writer Maggie Nelson about her latest book, The Argonauts. That is coming right up. And, yep, right after this here on KBOO. Thanks for listening.
I'm a loving the old lion, a winner without fail.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the PDX Leo Party, Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian. A birthday celebration for all you Portland Leos, with special performances from Sleep of Old Dominion and the Chicharrones, Mike Crenshaw, Smoke M2D6, and many more. Again, that's the PDX Leo Party on Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian, located at 426 Southwest Washington Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Matt Dishman Community Center annual block party on Saturday, August 8th from noon to 4 p.m. This family-friendly event will include barbecue grub, live music and a DJ, activities for kids, family swim in the pool, local vendors, and more. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center annual block party on Saturday, August 8th from noon to 4 p.m. at Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 42 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday through Christmas Eve. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is genre-defying essayist, poet, and scholar Maggie Nelson. Her books of poetry include Something Bright Than Holes, The Latest Winter, and Shiner, which was a finalist for the Poetry Society of America's Norma Farber First Book Award. Her critical work includes Women, The New York School, and Other True Abstractions, a look at the New York School Poets and Painters, which won the Suzanne M. Glasscock Award for Interdisciplinary Scholarship, and The Art of Cruelty, A Reckoning, a study of aesthetics and cruelty that was named a 2011 New York Times Notable Book of the Year. But much of Maggie Nelson's work is harder to categorize than this. Jane, A Murder is considered poetry and memoir. Her best-known book, Bluettes, has been described variably as nonfiction, lyric essay, as poetry, as a blend of scholarship and poetry. And The Red Parts, a memoir, is both autobiography and an examination of sexual violence and media spectacle. Maggie Nelson is on the faculty of the School of Critical Studies at the California Institute of the Arts. She's a recipient of the Guggenheim Fellowship in Nonfiction, a National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship in Poetry, and an Innovative Literature Grant from Creative Capital. She's here today on Between the Covers to talk about her new book, The Argonauts, a meditation on a relationship with her partner, the fluidly gendered artist Harry Dodge, on queer family making and on the limitations and the possibilities of language. As writer Chloe Caldwell aptly describes, the Argonaut lives in a gorgeous gray area that explores language, lust, loss, the ebb and flow of bodies, and limitations on identity and labels. The personal narrative is threaded with theory and criticism, employing a collage technique that Nelson has mastered and made her own. Welcome to Between the Covers.
Thank you very much. That was very nice. Thank you, Dave.
You've described the Argonauts as auto theory in some interviews. Can you tell us what you mean by auto theory to start out?
Yeah, you know, it's a term that actually now I know emanates from feminist criticism, which makes sense, you know, in terms of troubling the line between subjectivity and objectivity and using the self in the theoretical writing. And then, but I stole it from Beatrice Preciado, now Paul Preciado's book, Testo Junkie, which was published in Europe several years ago, but just a couple of years ago was translated into English and published by the Feminist Press. And I love that book, and it was useful to me. And I thought her description of the book in its opening pages as auto theory, or a body essay, she also called it, in terms of, you know, other works of mine have used philosophy, or they've used, you know, like Bluett's is more kind of aesthetic theory or color theory or things like that. But this book was really more engaged in, you know, theory, specifically mostly, you know, gender, sexuality, and critical race theory. It was kind of a love letter to my kind of 20 years ago education and then things since, you know. And so, but it's also very autobiographical and personal, as are some things that I write, and it weaves the two together, you know.
Well, it does seem like Bluett's is also an example of auto theory in your work, but in a way it feels like that the Argonauts is both more personal and more theoretical at the same time. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think of Bluett's as I see why they have similarities, but to me, just as a writer, they're really different writerly experiments, because Bluett's is, it's allegorical, it's novelistic, it doesn't have named names, it has, its inspiration in part for its voice was something more like David Markson's Wittgenstein's Mistress, or something kind of like its first line is, "Suppose I were to begin by saying," so to me that's about as novelistic as like I get, you know, like, and it's a suspended state. And this book is very, you know, its first line is October 2007, you know, so it's starting off, you know, in the realm of spatiotemporal embodied fact, and the personal remains that way. So I mean, I wouldn't call it more personal. I would just call it a different way of rendering or experiencing personal information, which has more to do with facticity and not the kind of, I don't know, abstract expressionist internal landscape of Bluett's or something like that, you know? And then the theoretical, it is more theoretical because it's literally, it's not, it's explicitly a dialogue with, you know, feminist and queer theorists that have meant something to me, and people who are, for the most part, would self-identify as theorists in that way. So, I mean, there are other people, there are poets and artists and other things, but it's really more back in the, you know, 70s or in the 80s anthology called This Bridge Called My Back, Radical Writings by Women of Color. You know, they talked a lot in there about theory being used for survival, you know, and I think that what a lot of people have said about this book, and I think that it's true, is that it's interested in eschewing that whole ivory tower notion of, like, there's theory over here and praxis over here. I mean, this is a very old idea, the theory-praxis breakdown. This is, like, really not today's news, I think, but I'd never tried to I tried to do anything that just so explicitly was so kind of unashamed of using theoretical sources, I guess, that in a non-academic setting.
Yeah. You know. Well, let's start with the autobiography and weave our way to the theoretical. Okay. The book begins with a juxtaposition of you and your partner both going through a metamorphosis of sorts. Mm-hmm. Your partner, Harry's going through surgery and starting to take testosterone, so he's changing physically and physiologically, and you, after many failed attempts, are pregnant, and you in a more familiar sense to most probably are also changing physically and physiologically. Tell us a little bit about that juxtaposition in terms of the enterprise of the Argonauts.
I think while all that was happening, a lot of people in my life were like, oh, you've got to write about this. It's so interesting. And, you know, it always really burned me up, you know, like I just felt like, what? What's so interesting? Like, you're sensationalistic. You know, you think what's great. Like, I just was very irritated by it. But, you know, under my irritation, of course, you know, and I probably was so irritated because it was interesting, but it was, I knew that since that was kind of like the, you know, and it indeed has been used as the kind of sensationalist tagline about the book, you know, that the book, in some ways, its raison d'etre became about, I mean, I can't get inside Harry's experience, but kind of trying to get underneath what the simplified headlines, you know, are that are often incorrect about what, you know, but what am I trying to say? That the way that either female or in this case something that might be called transgender experience is very freely pontificated upon and dissected and criticized and critiqued or whatever from afar, but that there was a kind of internal experience of being inside bodies that I wanted to try and bear a certain kind of witness to, and that that bearing witness would not fit under those taglines, you know, like the tagline, for example, the New York Times used was, you know, Nelson, the author undergoes a pregnancy while her partner transitions from male or female to male, but that, you know, we actually wrote them in correction because there's nothing in the book that supports that language about my partner's bodily transformations. That he, you know, that's not how he conceives of his transition. But in this moment, when there's a lot of focus on trans issues, it's, I think, very important to keep sending out specific experiences that don't fit whatever cookie cutter, you know, the like New York Times, you know, op-eds right. are feeding to us that given day, because the point is specificity and diversity of letting human beings have their own experiences of their bodies and their selves, and the gender is part of that. And the point is not making a new category and then trying to get people to fit into it, because that's where the violence happens, you know. So I think in this case, you know, and I should also say that Harry's body is not the only, you know, it's the most obviously queer body to people who don't, maybe, you know, from afar or something in the text, but also part of the book was, you know, it's an exploration of the pregnant body as a queer body, or just the body as a queer experience, and just getting at non-normative, you know, the fundamental weirdnesses of being alive in bodies, and that's something that everybody partakes in, rather than this being about special people undergoing special experiences, which is why in the kind of culminative passage about these two parallel metamorphoses, it says, you know, from the outside, it may have looked as though, you know, your body was growing more and more male and mine more and more female, but from the inside, that's not how it felt. You know, we were aging, you know, we were bearing each other witness, and, you know, as we were, you know, growing alongside each other and, you know, aging. I mean, it's kind of a punchline, but it's also, that's what everybody is doing every day, you know, as we're changing unto ourselves and each other, you know. So.
Yeah, and I really love that part of The Argonauts where you trouble the idea of pregnancy being normal. Of mm-hmm. course, it's normal and yeah. it's normative, and yeah. the culture is, you know, pushes people yeah. towards that yeah. being a way yeah. of identifying as a woman, as mm-hmm. a mother. Mm-hmm. But you really defamiliarize it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I love the part where you talk about how strange it is, as normal as it actually mm-hmm. is also, that you could produce or manufacture mm-hmm. a male body mm-hmm. inside of a female body.
Right.
That was yeah. was really...
I mean, part of the book is, what I want to say, like, there are people who have said, like, how could you talk about growing a male body like that in a book that's all about troubling, you know, gender binaries or something. But the book is not, how do I say it? There are a lot of moods or questions in the book, you know, and in one mood, you know, I may be meditating on what it's like to, you know, be pregnant with or have a son. And in other moods, I may be, you know, letting go of the notion of son or male altogether. You know, there are different moods, and the narrator, you know, of the book is a testifier to different questions, you know, and different experiences. And yeah, I mean, the pregnancy question is deep because it's, I mean, I guess this gets at before we were on the air and we were talking about the meaning of the word queer. And I think, you know, you don't get at the meaning of that word by saying, like, is pregnancy queer or isn't it queer? You know, it's, insofar as if the word means looking for the elements of experience, or for some maybe a political action or whatever it is, that don't, you know, line up with all of the expectations that are policed as normativity, then really that has to do with, in some ways, you know, as much of an interior experience of what you're undergoing as a human as it does as to what is told to you from the outside. So I think you could most certainly have a queer experience of your pregnancy, whether or not, you know, you're never going to, no gavel is going to come down from on high to determine whether pregnancy actually really is essentially a queer thing to do. I mean, that would be preposterous kind of things to say. So there's a lot of questioning in the book about, you know, where resistance and where change comes from, you know, internally or externally, and how it gets enacted, and how to trouble also the line between, you know, the transgressive and the normal, because I think people kind of torture themselves and or each other by trying to make those designations have content as opposed to, for lack of a better term, you know, revolutionary impulse, you know.
Well, while we're on this topic, and I can't remember whether this is from an interview I read of yours or was in the Argonauts, but there was, you spoke to the term transgender, mm-hmm. where you said, yes, it could be considered a specific group of people, but another broader definition of transgender could include nearly everybody, mm-hmm. even in certain circumstances, mm-hmm. White, heteronormative mm-hmm. men. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the troubling of that mm-hmm. word, just mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. sort of in the way that you did mm-hmm. around queer.
Well, it's hard to talk about that word right now, I think, because the word is in the process of kind of being disciplined. Like the word queer, the word transgender kind of came about, you know, historically to differentiate from transsexual to be a much broader category involving more people with maybe more diverse impulses than a desire to transition surgically to a different gender, you know. While the word had that large umbrella root, we're not using it really. I mean, we are a little bit, but we're going straight to Caitlyn Jenner, transgender person, and Caitlyn Jenner is not necessarily speaking, I mean, you know, God bless her gender, whatever, you know, whatever it is, but she's not necessarily speaking what might have been an original, I don't know, this is hard to get into. Anyway, it's a term that's undergoing a lot of disciplining right now, so I think it's difficult. I think what I was getting at, what you're talking about the term being broader, it's not, I would never want to, there are human beings who experience on a daily basis a kind of gender dysphoria, to use the, you know, pathologized term that we've been given, that I do not believe everybody experiences. And I would never want to mow over that very real thing and say, it's something we all have. You know, that's right. That's not a good mode, right? Because then that presumes that we just start shellacking other people's experience about what we feel, and that doesn't work. People do feel very radically different about gender experience, and that diversity is like the number one thing I think that has to be reckoned with and accepted. But secondly, I guess, but on the other hand, I do think that it's a you know, a big mistake to, you know, feminism has a long history of women feeling like, well, I'm not only woman all the time. You know, gender is a flickering nature. You know, we have lots of queer people feeling the same way. And it would, you know, it would be profoundly, to me, politically disappointing to devastating should the bodies of, you know, cisgendered, you know, heterosexual men be the ones that were just presumably the ones that need do no questioning. You know, we all, I think everybody has a complicated relationship to the disciplinary categories of gender and sexuality unto which we are born. And I think that's why Eve Sedgwick, who's was my teacher and who's at issue a lot in this book, why her work is so meaningful to me was because, not vis-a-vis gender, but vis-a-vis sexuality, she was always asking questions like, why on earth would homo and hetero be the defining features of a sexuality? Like, why wouldn't it be, you know, you like fat or skinny, you like old or young, you like, you know, multiple partners or one partner? Like, there's so many aspects of a sexuality. And if you go to any porn site, I know, I'm sorry, it's not family friendly radio, but like, you can edit this out. But like, if you go to any porn site, I mean, it's one of the most beautiful things. It's like ostensibly straight sexuality is full of, you know, can you play, I won't go into it, but whatever, you know, like, right. Can you please put shaving cream on a toenail and, you know, whatever. It's like there's, it's so diverse. Right. So I think that's not about gender, that's about sexuality, which is very different. But I think at the same time, it's really, you know, the disaster comes when we presume normativity is all great and fine. It's just these poor bodies that don't fit into it. Let's give them some rights. That's not the revolutionary image for how we might better be able to inhabit our diverse genders and sexualities, to me, you know.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to author Maggie Nelson about her latest book, The Argonauts. This seems like a perfect time to talk about the theoretical, because you've talked about the difficulty of categorization, the limitations of categorization, the potential violence from over-categorization. And at the beginning of the book, you not only talk about your personal lives and the changes that the two of you are going through together and separately, but you talk about the ways you've constructed your lives in relationship to language and identified around a specific relationship to language that were polar opposite to each other. Can you talk a little bit about the way Harry looked at language at the beginning of The Argonauts and what you brought to the beginning of The Argonauts?
It's funny. Someone asked me recently what I thought the central conflict of this book was, and I think they thought I was going to say something about gender and sexuality, but I actually said, no, it's this opening fight with Harry about language. I mean, they're related, but I think that the, you know, basically, like, I mean, Harry's a words person, too. We're both words people. Harry, even though as a visual artist and a performance artist, you know, is a kind of, people have kind of mistakenly, until they've gotten to know his work, read this book and thought, oh, you're the words person, he's the image person. Not at all. It's more just that I've had this kind of sometimes glib, sometimes profound belief that, you know, I'm unworried about what words can't do because I'm so enraptured with what they can do. And I have this Wittgensteinian belief, which is on the first page, that you know, as he says, the inexpressible is contained inexpressibly in the expressed. So kind of instead of this paranoia about that which is ineffable, you just point your sights on specificity and articulation and trust that whatever can't be captured in language or falls out of it is just kind of it's hovering there, it's present, kind of like, you know, a Holy Spirit. I mean, at least for Wittgenstein, it was theological like that. You know, Harry, at least when we first met, was much more kind of, you know, he has a kind of, I'm trying to remember his name, kind of a Derek Jarman, is that his name, like primitivist streak, kind of about, like, you know, he's a fierce ecologist and feels a little bit like, you know, he kind of, I think, aligned and aligns language with one of all the many forces that have moved us further and further from, you know, our harmonious and decent relationship with our planet and other things like that. So the opening, you know, has to do with, you know, and Harry feeling very much, and this comes from gender, but it's not in any way entirely about gender, but about, you know, Harry's experience as a person, as a non-normatively gendered person, that, I mean, as he says, like, language around gender ever since he was younger struck him as, like, literally, like, medieval or worse. He just couldn't believe the crude, cookie-cutterness of language that people used, because it never related to anything he felt inside. But that was just, gender is just one example. He feels like that about a lot of things. So he kind of has a very fierce agony and frustration with both language's effects and with its inadequacies. And so, you know, some people have said I wrote the book to prove that I win because it's my words and I'm trying to show what language, you know, I'm trying to give an example of how you can express and contain the inexpressible. I think of it as more of a truce because, you know, it was important to me that at a certain point, actually, I inserted language of Harry's because he's a beautiful writer, and I wanted to trouble, I mean, in addition to the many things that inserting his own language does, one of them was that I wanted to trouble this idea that to be critical of language meant you didn't use it beautifully, because he does, and he's describing a death scene in which I think he very much conjures the ineffable about going through that portal and describing his mother's death, you know.
I do, too. I feel like, I don't feel like there's a winner at the end.
Right. Yeah.
Strangely, I feel like at the beginning it's a theoretical question.
Yeah.
that is juxtaposed with what's happening in the changes that are happening physically and what are structurally to your family.
Yeah.
But by the end, it feels like it's very much on the body. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and when, I think it's really powerful when we get to hear Harry's words.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but when he's describing the deathbed scene of his mother, a lot of the imagery is very... much about liberation and about life.
Yeah.
And you're going through birth, but a lot of the imagery seems to be about like the abyss death and about near death.
I've no one's pointed that out, but I think that's really true. And it's probably true of our natures in general, which is that I think that, you know, I'm describing that bursting as in what I'm calling like being in the pain cavern and this kind of harrowing solitude, and he's describing going out and looking at fireflies and a kind of dissemination, which is a very important concept to him about, you know, I think he has a felt sense of where we come from cellularly that I struggle to have.
Well, it's interesting that I don't know, certainly I don't know nearly as much about Wittgenstein as you do, but it's interesting that you choose him partially because he changed a lot around his relationship to what language could do. Because at the beginning, tell me if I'm wrong, but didn't he at the beginning have a theory of one-to-one correspondence that in the Tractatus, and then later he changed it entirely? Yeah. Like, was he troubled and evolving around it?
You tell me more, because this is an area that between the early and late Wittgenstein, that I mean, I love the Tractatus and I love philosophical investigations. I know there are huge chasms in between them, but I'm so much more of a impressionistic reader, so I'm curious.
Well, I don't know that I could do anything on it, but But I did.
Yeah.
I do think it at the beginning. He believed in a direct one-to-one between the word and what it was referring to, and then abandoned it. Called it the thoughts of a crazy person.
Interesting.
Later on.
Interesting. Yeah.
But this idea of distrust of language that Harry has that goes way back in philosophy, doesn't it? I mean, I think even Plato was talking about how it distanced people.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I go through that in Bluets actually, because I'm talking about. Yeah, I talk about the Socrates calling color pharmakon, but it was also a means of describing, you know, language as that which is both, you know, that which might cure us and that which harms us, you know, the poison and the poison and the cure. And so I think in some ways that's it's the same concept at play with via the Wittgenstein in this book as well.
Tell us a little bit about, you include Harry's words, but it's at one point you're concerned about what you ended up writing about. So writing about your family, both about your child who can't speak for himself, and about your partner who's private, and then you have your own issues around how much you want to reveal and how much you don't. And you consider briefly in The Argonauts doing a enterprise of co-writing. You're leaning towards that and then your retreat.
Well, I didn't consider doing it in The Argonauts. I mean, I think some review I read said this book was like co-written or something, and I was like, oh no, it wasn't. You know, I think what was interesting to me about that slippage was that if you show your hand and show that, like, there's a scene in here where I show Harry a draft, and because I say I allowed him to make, you know, comments in mechanical pencil for me to consider, like, that doesn't make something co-written. That's like what most people do with nonfiction books that are going to involve intimate details of someone that, you know, who's named. So that's not really a very new thing. But I do also talk about in the book that it wasn't this book, but that when we first met, you know, and we're very in love and we remain so, but in that flush of like all the things you think you're going to do together, you know, we talked about writing a book together. But as I say in this book, it eventually caused me too much anxiety, because I just, you know, I go to work in writing to know what I think and sometimes to know what I feel. And I'm a strong person, but I can bend in the wind of other people. And I think that has a gendered aspect as well. And so writing is a really kind of sacred space for me to figure things out without any watchful eye. I mean, this is a very cliched rendition of what, you know, the solitary writer, but it's true. So I think that, but what I just kind of showed my hand in this book was that I did do that. And then I also, you know, let somebody else have some veto power over some parts, and that eventually, since the book is really about interdependence, as a concept and as an ethics, I guess, it made sense to me to underscore those elements of its writing, and that and for that reason include Harry's words as well. I mean, I'm not heading towards more collaboration. Like, this was probably about as much as I could bear, but I felt as though, given the topicality, I mean, the topic of the book and their interdependence, it's about, you know, obviously with Harry, it's about a relationship, but it's also about, you know, a family, it's about gestation, it's about politics, it's about our general American disgust and distaste for people with needs, and the way we feminize the concept of having needs and taking care of them, and then denigrate the feminine in turn. And so in order to, you know, not have a nanny state, or, you know, be whipped or mommy whipped or whatever, we, you know, have a very, I think, very disciplinary fatherly logic about, you know, non-unconditional love and how you can get basic needs met, and, you know, and all of that to me is fairly repugnant. So it doesn't mean that I'm imagining a, you know, this is not a matriarchal fantasy about nurturance. It's actually, the book, I think, was meant to show, you know, there's hardnesses and abjection and difficulty in the scenes of care. And some of the scenes of the book are about when, you know, care fails, because care fails. We fail each other a lot, too, you know.
Well, I think that the fact that you invite Harry to read your first draft, mm-hmm. and that we get to see that in process, yeah. and yeah. that you don't have the answers, yeah. you pose the questions, and we get to be on your shoulder as you, yeah. you trouble your way through,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
through the
yeah.
the contradictions. It reminded me of when I had Leslie Jamison on, she mm-hmm. quoted Charles D'Ambrosio, who said mm-hmm. something like, sometimes the problem with an essay can become its subject.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
it feels like you allow
mm-hmm.
the actual mm-hmm. concerns you have about the writing mm-hmm, become part mm-hmm. of the writing.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way that yeah. is an asset to the writing, mm-hmm, strangely.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's like, I think that's a, you know, as a teacher, it's a kind of truism that I would say a lot to students about letting the problem of the writing be the subject. There are perils in that there's a kind of trendy way of doing that where we never feel like we're actually getting, you know, like there's a kind of very, I don't know, like a kind of incrustation of self-referentiality about that process. And I, you know, I try in the books to have that layering without having it be, you know, I'm always aiming to be like a laser, not to do any obfuscating, you know, and I'm always aiming to really, you know, to use that kind of exposing of the performativity of writing, not to bring us further away from the kind of raw nerves of the thing, but to get closer to it. And I like writing when it does that, you know, and exposes the terms of its production, you know.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to writer Maggie Nelson about her latest book, The Argonauts. One of the sections that I really loved in The Argonauts, mm-hmm. Maggie, was the story of your feminist theory teacher, uh-huh. Christina. And
yeah.
you told two
yeah.
stories. You told yeah. one about a coup that happens in her
right.
classroom.
yeah.
And then you tell another about her being your thesis advisor, even
right.
though she
right.
found aspects of your work.
Yeah.
I don't know if you used the word repellent.
I think I might have said repulsive.
Yeah. So
could you
touch yeah. on both of those incidents and,
sure.
and
yeah, yeah.
what comes up
yeah.
from both of those?
Well, the Christina Crosby, who was my feminist theory teacher and who's a dear friend of mine, and who's actually the my injured friend in Bluettes, and she oh. actually has a book coming out next year that I'll just, you know, plug for. It's called, I think it'll be called Body Undone. It's about her accident that left her in a, you know, quadriplegic, but she, at the point in The Argonauts that I'm writing about her, she is, well, the two stories are, the first one is just about her students kind of throwing a coup where they wanted her and other people to kind of, I don't know, identify more fiercely, and had a, they staged class away from the classroom and then gave people an index card and a Sharpie to write like how you identified at the, this kind of height of like 90s identity politics. And, you know, for her, who'd been kind of teaching deconstruction and deconstructing identity, and this was very, very painful episode. So, and she wrote Lover of Babe, which was her dog, on her card, which kind of reminds me of, you know, Foucault when asked, you know, how he identified, he would say as a reader, you know, but like these kind of different ways that we give to get out of the, I keep using the word disciplinary today. I don't know why. I must have, you know, drank it with morning coffee, but like, you know, the disciplinary aspect of of identification. Anyway, so that's the first story. And the second story was just how she was at that point fairly averse to the personal and writing. And so I wanted to write a thesis as a college kid that was kind of half my own poetry and then half was a scholarly essay on Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton and notions of confession. And she was kind of like, I don't know about this mixing together of these modes, you know, but you're smart, so we'll give it a try. But that's why I also put in the plug for her beautiful book, Body Undone, because, you know, you fast forward 20 years. Not only are we in these changed forms where I'm an adult and have changed in my ways, and she's in this radically changed form from an athlete to a quadriplegic, but she's also changed in terms of, you know, her last book was about Victorian literature, and her new book is this, you know, excoriating and lovely account, kind of vis-a-vis phenomenology and about what it means to have a body and what it means to have a damaged body. You know, so it's kind of a, you know, it's a deep pleasure to. Not her injury, which is a deep sadness, but her capacity to move to writing about the self, and so beautifully is a lovely link that now we share, you know.
You cite in an interview a really interesting thing around the subject of the private and the public, mm-hmm. From a Chris Krauss review of mm-hmm. Eileen Miles. Mm. Like Kathy Acker, Miles values the most intimate and shameful details of her life, not for what they tell her about herself, but for what they tell us about the culture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that's really a fascinating
take. I mean, the thing I like about that is that, I mean, I think that's what's the phrase, like Monday morning quarterbacking, like later on you can be like, yes, these details tell you about the culture. I think, you know, at the moment of writing, like I don't care, and I wouldn't encourage any writers to care. Like, you can't be like, oh, this private detail will tell us something about the culture and this one won't, you know. You just write out what you need to write out. But I think that, you know, I don't believe there are any private details that don't tell us anything about the culture, and kind of vice versa. So
right.
I don't really know. Since I see no, I mean, I hear people all the time rehearse this issue. I can't believe we're still talking about it, honestly, but people still rehearse this issue about this, you know, bifurcation of our private lives and of, you know, public life. And I think part of it to me is political, in that certain bodies, I mean, black bodies, female bodies, you know, privacy is a gendered concept, and many people have not had access to either privacy or a public space, or public space in the same way. I mean, they still don't, hence Black Lives Matter and everything else. I mean, we don't experience privacy and public space the same way depending on the forms of body we have. So given that, when people even talk about privacy in the public, as opposed, I don't even know often what they're even talking about, you know, because, I mean, obviously it's a very, you know, cliche, but, you know, even Roe versus Wade, you know, stands on the privacy of woman's relationship with her doctor. Well, what is that? I mean, why is that the kind of reproductive justice we want? You know, not to me, you know, like, I'd be much happier to have it be a much more public decision, you know, not a, right. It doesn't need to be a private, you know, this whole privacy thing. I'm like, it's not private. It's just non-enforced childbearing. Like, that just seems like we could all get behind that in a public way, you know?
Right.
So I think that I'm just, I like the Chris Krauss statement, not so much for like its indication there may be ones that don't tell us about the culture, but more about Eileen Miles as a writer, as somebody who's very practiced in making those links between the private and the cultural, just as a kind of commonplace in the work.
And that term she uses, vernacular scholarship.
Yeah.
That I think you do really, I really love the format, the materiality of the text in Argonauts in specific, the way that the quotes of these different thinkers are actually enmeshed seamlessly in the body of the text, just italicized, and you can look over and see who said it, or you can continue reading the text. It's this conversation that it just flows through with your own words. It's interesting.
That's good. Yeah, I mean, ever since, I mean, I got a PhD in ever since I, you know, been doing academic writing, I've been trying to undo and find out how to use other people's quotes in a way that is, that really performs how deeply a part of your thought they become. And every book I do, I try something a little bit different. You know, this book, The Marginal Attribution, seemed to work. In Bluets, I use parentheses.
This is my favorite one.
Oh, great. Yeah. I don't know if it will recur or not. It really is just cribbed from Roland Barthes, like everything else about my work. So.
Do you use index cards like he does, or like he did? Like he would have those in files of index cards, and then
I don't. I use some index cards actually for a book of mine, The Red Parts, but I think that's the last. Oh, and I used them in Bluets, I guess. Those are the last index cards I've had.
Yeah. Well, what I really love about the vernacular scholarship, mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, when I was growing up and listening to an album of somebody, and I could read the liner notes mm-hmm. and see who they learned how mm-hmm, to play mm-hmm, from mm-hmm. or
yeah.
who they were listening to.
Yeah.
And then you could follow the family tree of the specific
yeah.
musician.
Yeah,
and it would
yeah.
lead you, you had no idea where you'd be three steps
yeah.
from there.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
you've
yeah.
really, you've yeah. really made transparent,
mm-hmm,
it seems
mm-hmm.
to me, a family tree.
Yeah.
If we want to follow
yeah.
your thinking.
Yeah.
It would be very easy to come up
yeah.
with 20, 30 books
yeah.
from here.
Yeah, I mean, it always kills me when people say, like, you know, so what were some of the inspirations for this book? I'm like, dude, have you read the book? Because, like, you know, like, I mean, there are maybe some closet inspirations, but not really. I mean, the book is a record of its, you know, it's an, whatever you call it, autobiographia literaria. But I think that at the same time, I mean, this book in particular was very important that it be that way because it's about, for lack of a better term, family, but it's about the different meanings of that word. And, you know, in some ways, even though it's about quote unquote my family, you know, my family is also my intellectual family. And that's why in some ways the book is called The Argonauts, because I wanted a word that was people and like a tribe doing something together. And there are so many heroes of mine that, you know, that this book is, you know, everybody from, I don't know, just Audre Lorde and to James Baldwin, to, you know, you name it, they're all like in there. So I think it's like, it was important to me to kind of imagine this ship, you know, ship of fools that we're all, that we're all in at times together, you know.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to writer Maggie Nelson about her latest book, The Argonauts. Well, I do think you reveal a lot of the family tree, but you also answered about some sources in an interview and in an mm-hmm. article, and some of them were surprising. Like some were not mm-hmm, surprising. Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned Susan Sontag mm-hmm, as a touchstone mm-hmm, and James mm-hmm, Baldwin, and
mm-hmm.
I can see that in a lot of your work actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then for this book, you mentioned someone that was surprising, and I'd be curious just to hear a little bit about
Emerson. Is that
Emerson,
what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Like, I never
yeah.
thought of Emerson reading
right.
The
yeah,
Argonauts.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about Emerson.
Oh, Emerson's all scattered all over my books. I think what happened with Emerson was that, I mean, like everything in life, I attribute it to two great teachers of mine. One was Annie Dillard, who was my teacher early on, and who obviously is known as a, you know, I mean, she married the Emerson biographer, who's also a
oh, really?
Lovely friend of mine, Bob Richardson, and he's a biographer of Emerson, Thoreau, and William James, and then I had a teacher in graduate school, Jerome Richardson, who loved Emerson, and I took many, 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 many semesters of a course called American Aesthetics that in many ways used kind of Jonathan Edwards, Emerson, this kind of mix between the natural and the theological swirl of, you know, a kind of branch of nonfiction writing that doesn't, I'm not, you know, it's not sermons, and it's not, you know, what are those essays of Emerson's? They're sermonistic, but they are, how do I say it? Like they, I don't think I have this in the Argonauts actually stylistically at all, but they set up shop in my mind. My image of Emerson essays is often I'll be like imagining them happening like a windy stair somewhere, or like in a, or rolling around in a kind of rainbow colored cosmological space. Like they're very strange in terms of like where the writing is happening, you know? And I think that is totally fascinating. And I just think, you know, there are so many Emerson lines that are kind of branded onto my head, and many of them appear here. You know, the one in here, I think, that recurs is about him saying that spirit is matter, you know, pressed so thin, and his own, I mean, this relates to what I was talking about with Harry before and about ecology, but his Emerson's own migration, I guess, about thinking about what spirit is and what matter is and what they have to do with each other, and is nature the kind of term in between that negotiates? And I am very interested in those questions.
Well, let's continue on that, on that thread of spirit and matter, because another question I have is around Buddhism, because it occurs in several of your books, and you've mentioned Chogyam Trungpa as one of the canon for you, as one of the canonical writers. Is it an influence on your writing? Part of the reason I ask is because you talk at one point about leaning on the writing of others and letting the writing of others haunt you. And and the way you describe that often feels like it has a resonance with like a collective consciousness. And I wondered if that came from anything around Buddhism for you and your writing.
I mean, you know, I'm not a Buddhist, and I'm a reader of Buddhist texts, you know, not a practicing Buddhist, although I've sat my share on the pillow, but but I'm, you know, unaffiliated. But I think that in reading Buddhist texts of varying kind, and I am partial to the crazy wisdom of Chogyam Trungpa, but I just find that Western thought gets involved in these knots they seem very laughable sometimes when they are so quickly dispensed with when you read Buddhist texts. And when I was writing about cruelty anything that poses these binaries that seem to flummox the heck out of us, they're just, you know, when you understand the relationship of this kind of, you know, non-duality, I mean, it sounds so cheesy, but it's just very true. So like if you're like in the cruelty book, The Art of Cruelty, you know, I'm writing about this notion of like things having near enemies and far enemies as concepts, and, you know, and like compassion being a near enemy of cruelty, or these different, I don't know, they're just these, all these different mappings and ways that to me are very, very useful of thinking of things like near and far enemies, or, you know, the unsurprise of having one thing appear where it seems banished, but of course it's also, you know, sharing roots. I don't know. So I think that there's a lot there, and I think that, and then, you know, Roland Barthes, his whole book, The Neutral, which I really love, which is very much about picking third ways in between, under the kind of menacing pressure to take sides. But those third ways, I mean, this is being now echoed in a lot of anarchist Western writing, specifically, I think a lot of like post-Occupy writing, when in that movement people were talking a lot about, it's so strange, they don't seem to be asking for anything, you know, but to people who are kind of practitioners of this, is like they're very clearly choosing a third way. And, you know, and reflecting a lot of recent political writing about non-participation, changing the terms, refusing the terms that are offered to you, all these different things. So that to me has a very strong Buddhist element that I find as a critical thinker, it agitates some people who find my writing to be inconclusive. Like when I wrote the cruelty book, I remember doing some radio or some show where, you know, it was like, oh, that's all really well and good that you're putting all this violence and art in context, but tell me, you know, do you think watching violence makes us more cruel as people, you know? And I was like, right, like, you know, and you feel like, you know, you feel bad because you're like, oh, that's what you really want. You know, you just want me to tell you. But, you know, I'm just not that person. And that will prohibit me from being a certain kind of public intellectual. But it will allow me, hopefully, to be the kind that I actually am, which is somebody who is more interested in specificity and context and the true action of criticism, which to me is more about the mind in motion, you know.
Is that your attraction to Deleuze as a philosopher? Because when you talk about in Buddhism giving you a way to sidestep the terms of like not inherit the questions necessarily of the Western tradition, it feels like he kind of does that.
Yeah.
In a way, he's like, well, the mind and the body might not be the same thing, but it might not be the crucial question we should be asking. And so he just starts from another place. And it's so weirdly radical.
Yeah.
But so simple at the same time.
Well, you get into this knot where you think, okay, here are the main questions, mind-body question, whatever, and you think to move on, you have to solve them, you know, but the action of just saying, huh, interesting, but shrug, I think the action's over here, you know, is a very worthwhile one. And I can remember when even being really, really young, like in high school, I read a book of John Cage interviews. I didn't know anything about his Buddhist inflections or anything, but what I was obsessed with was when interviewers, here we are, That's why I say I've learned this skill. I don't always use it. But, you know, interviewers would ask him a question and he would say, forgive me, I don't think that's an interesting question. And I just couldn't believe that he sounded so polite and so untriggered, as we say. And yet he just refused that. He just said it was, and he just said it wasn't interesting. He didn't say it was wrong or angering. He just said, it's not interesting. That's not an interesting question to me. So I just think that forgive me, I don't find that interesting question. It's just a kind of constant, I hear it in like a British accent, which he didn't have, but I just hear it kind of ringing in my mind as this endless possibility. And then behind it, the goat is, you know, what is the interesting question and how do we get there, you know?
Well, let's return to the beginning briefly. You said that some people wondered whether the Argonauts was you winning the argument around language against Harry's argument. And that definitely wasn't my opinion, but you described the book ending in a truce. Do you feel like that's true? That wasn't my experience of it, it being a truce. I don't know that I could articulate it.
I think the question became uninteresting to both of us, you know, and I don't think it's as interesting for Harry at all anymore. And it is not interesting to me. I mean, there's a tradition of this too. Like I'm thinking of Richard Rorty's Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature. I don't know if you know that book, but where he just kind of says like, oh, you know, we've been using all these ocular metaphors about knowledge, like I see or whatever. And like, it was the wrong, we were on the wrong sense. Like it was the wrong metaphor. But, you know, these kind of moments where you just kind of turn the kaleidoscope, you know, and the reason why he came to mind is because he also very explicitly turns away from this idea of the problem of representation in being the problem, you know, like that there is a real, and how do we represent the real, and how do we live with the fact that we only can see through a glass darkly or whatnot, you know, and he just says, not, you know, wrong question, because every being or anything, you know, sentient is not perceiving the same world because the world's determined by our senses. So, I mean, I think Harry and I are still different, that he still believes there's a real somewhere. And I don't know that I do, but I think that in some ways, we both just have moved on to focusing on our own apertures. He always tells a story about when he was kind of self-taught and didn't go to college. And when he went to grad school for art, everyone was talking about representation and he didn't know. He thought they meant like political representation. He didn't know what they were talking about, you know. But he actually held that confusion of not knowing if we were talking about political representation or like art representation, you know. He actually held on to it for so long in a confusion but it kind of bloomed, and you know, he has a drawing of an Elmer's glue bottle that says, let no one represent you. And it's kind of funny because it's like saying like the objects of the world can't be represented, but it's also saying like, don't let anyone speak for you. But I think that this book is in some ways that conversation about language. The book is not political about like the representation of the queer or the feminist or the trans subject, but there is, I think, to a reader with a certain antenna on, there's a lot of the arguments that the book is making do undercut a certain normative political argument about representation and rights that would be like as if those are the only way to go as we try and find more equitable ways to live, you know?
Yeah.
I hope I'm not so far afield that seems to make sense.
That matches my experience more than the truce idea.
Right, yeah.
Somehow, I can't articulate it, but somehow I feel like your family making and your bodies in the book answer the question without words.
Right,
somehow.
I mean,
that doesn't make sense because you're using words.
Yeah.
But it ends in a place that feels like the question has fallen away.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's good. I hope so. You know, I hope so.
Well, can you talk a little bit about what Harry's working on now, if you feel comfortable, and maybe if you have an inkling what your next project is?
Well, Harry just had a big show in New York at his gallery, Wall Space. It was all mostly sculpture and a video. And he's taking a break by trying to visit a lot of national parks and clear his mind and get some, let the wells fill up, you know. I think that, again, with this question of representation, he's kind of been in a long, he began performing with his body and voice in film and on stage, and then has had a kind of long swing away, mostly because he felt like his body was so confusing for people that he couldn't just convey what he was meaning to convey, because everyone was just like, why does he have a beard, you know? And like, they couldn't take those leaps. So he kind of removed himself physically from his art for a very long time, and either collaborated with people who were performers or made abstract, drawing and sculpture. And he's just started, the video that just went up in New York was him performing, and I think he'll probably do more performance again now. And I think that he's also, he's really interested in questions about technology. His show was called The Cybernetic Fold, which is an antiquated term now from, it's a non-current use, but I think he's, it refers to a Sedgwick essay that aims to trouble the binary between the analog and the digital, and to show how analog and digital systems are usually always, even in our human bodies, like we have some systems inside that are digital, I mean, not digital, digitized, but that have like, they're like, they work on an on-off, and then analogs work on a kind of grayscale. So he's very interested in those questions, and we'll probably keep making sculptures that try and attend to those physically and other work. And I don't know. This book interrupted a book that I wanted to write that was a more scholarly book about kind of the fate of emancipatory logics from the 60s to the present. I'm not sure if I'll go back to that, but as a kind of offshoot of that, I'm working on writing something about Carolee Schneeman, who's a performance artist and a visual artist and a filmmaker, who was also very interested in emancipatory practice. And I'm interested in whether or not it's a good thing in some ways that we've given up on a discourse about freedom and emancipation that is that the ways in which, especially if it's opposed to what I was previously saying about interdependency or dependency, but I'm worried for us as we shut down, as notions of freedom become increasingly tinny as we head into the next presidential cycle. And we'll hear a lot about freedom, and we're not going to hear about very many visions of life that to me seem very free. So I'm curious about working on those things.
Well, I look forward to what comes next.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. It was great having you on Between
Thank
the Covers
you.
Today, Maggie.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. We're talking today to author Maggie Nelson about her new book, The Argonauts. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Thank you.
time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, July 30th, 2015. The Chi activists, who are currently gathered outside of Cathedral Park in the river, continue to blockade the Fenica ship, that is the icebreaker ship on its way to the Arctic, to help Shell begin its Arctic drilling. The 13 activists from Greenpeace are still suspended from the St. John's Bridge. This morning, a crane ship, as well as the Fenica, left dock, and the activists were concerned that they were going to be removed. Those ships then turned around. The latest is that there may be an injunction being filed in Alaska to stop Shell's Arctic drilling operation altogether. We will bring word to you about that later this afternoon. And today marks the 50th anniversary of Medicare. Oregonians will be gathering at sites around Oregon, as will Americans across the nation, to celebrate 50 years of Medicare. The activists organizing the protests say that Medicare and Medicaid have proven that people can be protected from economic ruin when their health demands attention. Here in Portland, at Pioneer Courthouse Square, right now, a rally is beginning called Celebration of 50 Years of Medicare and Medicaid. Let's keep it available for all and move to improve and expand it. And even while debate continues about the effectiveness of the Affordable Care Act, millions of Americans continue to enjoy publicly guaranteed health care through Medicare and Medicaid. Both programs were signed into law on July 30th, 1965 by President Lyndon Johnson. And the activists are also protesting the challenges to Medicare and Medicaid, particularly in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a trade agreement that threatens to undermine domestic law. As well, Medicare is being challenged, rather, by Republicans who are threatening to privatize and cut it back, and by access to care due to efforts to enroll